TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Nomi Prince, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. Nomi Prince was invited by the Santa Fe Lanin Foundation to give one of their prestigious talks. She took the stage at the Lansing Performing Arts Center in January 2018. Before her, Terry Tempest Williams, Glenn Greenwald, Arundhati Roy, Oscar Martinez, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and many others had spoken there. Nomi Prince was introduced by Juliet Shore, professor of sociology at Boston College. Shore focuses on the economy, environmental sustainability, women's issues, wealth inequality, and consumerism. Here first is Juliet Shore, followed by excerpts of the talk by Nomi Prince.
Nomi is a former banker, an author, a journalist, a senior fellow at Demos, and a very accomplished public speaker. She is a leading voice in our country on the role of finance in economics and politics. While she was still in college, she began working in finance at what was then called Chase Manhattan Bank. And afterwards, she took a full-time job at the bank as an analyst. She subsequently had a meteoric rise at a number of leading financial institutions, Lehman Brothers, where she created the financial analysts department, at Bear Stearns, where she spent 7 years running their analytics department, and eventually she went on to Goldman Sachs, where she was a managing director. Nomi would later write that in the U.S. we have government by Goldman and for Goldman. Prince has an amazing insider's seat, in particular the global financial collapse of 2008, which she details in her most recent book, Collusion, How Central Bankers Rigged the World. After 9/11, Prince left Goldman, in part after being told that she should not consider her clients to actually be her customers, but she should be working to please senior management, and that didn't sit too well with her. Since then, she's had a remarkable career as a writer and a journalist with a series of always heavily researched, engrossing books. In 2004, she wrote Other People's Money, The Corporate Mugging of America, which warned us about the financial debacle to come. And of course, she was one of the first and only insiders to warn about what would later occur with the collapse of 2008. She wrote It Takes a Pillage in 2009, which is Anatomy of the Crash. Wonderful titles. And then her magisterial All the President's Bankers in 2014, which is a book looking at a century of political influence by six behemoth financial institutions. And we're very fortunate tonight to have her. If you will all join me now in welcoming Nomi Prince.
Thank you for that lovely trip down my life. and thank you all so much for being here tonight. You know, special thanks. It's an honor to be speaking here on behalf of the Lanin Foundation. I want to step sort of back into how I am viewing what's going on, how it's really a manifestation of where we have been in the last 10 years since the financial crisis. I was on Wall Street when the financial crisis was being concocted, and one of the things I did back then, when I started to have some negative thoughts about the industry of which I had been a part since I was 19, since I started at Chase, was that it was starting to collapse the world. So even in the late 1990s, we had an Asian crisis. We had a Russian and Eastern European crisis. There was problems manifesting throughout the world that were results of the things that banks were doing with respect to pushing debt and different types of transactions and securities onto less informed and less capable of repaying that debt countries. And one of the things that I actually mentioned to some students today, I don't know if they're here, is that the uniqueness of being there in banking at Bear Stearns and going to something which was a huge demonstration in a city called Birmingham in the United Kingdom. And in Birmingham, many people from around Europe were coming and joining together to participate in a demonstration that was called Jubilee 2000. And the idea of Jubilee 2000 was that people should realize that the debt incurred upon countries that could not afford to repay it by banks and governments that could, and that had the wherewithal to achieve funds to repay debt if they took it on, but pushed it on other countries, was something that was unsustainable. And so there I was working as, at the time, a senior managing director at Bear Stearns, and sort of having all these thoughts about how unright this was. You know, I took off on a Friday to go on a weekend to drive up to Birmingham. And I was in a church before the demonstration, and there was a woman there named Ann Pettifor. She's a brilliant economist, very progressive. Now she, among many of the other things that she's done in her lifetime, advises Parliament on issues that relate to actual real populism and real economics and foundational economics. But by the time she'd come back from Africa, where there was a lot of problems, she had traversed through Africa, and she was just talking about the sort of devastation and the poverty on the ground, and a lot of it at the hands of sort of financial complex transactions that various governments had taken their own cuts of and then sort of imposed upon the people in their various countries. And she started to talk about these stories, and she started to just cry, you know, and I'm sitting there in this church, and you know, I got to go back to my day job at the bank on Monday, and it just kind of struck a real chord. And years later, I wrote to her and I said, you know, almost 20 years later, I was in this church, you know, at Jubilee 2000 in Birmingham, and I saw you, and like, oh my God, you're now sort of talking with a colleague of mine, and this is kind of the trajectory of where life has taken me, has taken the world, because on a lot of many elements, the world is so much less stable than it was in 1999. The debt that's been incurred upon these countries is so much worse than it was at the time, and nothing has really changed. In fact, in many instances, it has become significantly worse. And I just want to tell you that what you said to those people in that church before 1.5 million of us or so were holding hands around Birmingham and talking about canceling this debt, which didn't happen, that really struck a chord, and I just want to thank you. And she was very sweet, and we're now Twitter pals and everything else, and I hope to see her when I go to London to actually talk at Parliament when my book comes out. So the current book, in the process of writing it, I went around the world again. And I went around the world from Mexico to Brazil to Japan to China to throughout Europe and so forth, but different than I did when I was a banker. I was a junior sort of analyst on the futures and options desk at Lehman Brothers in the early 90s. And the things that we did back then were sort of the nascent financial engineering elements of what became derivatives, of what became toxic assets, of what ultimately imploded the financial system in 2008. But back then, they were sort of simpler. So when 2008 happened, it was because our banks like now J.P. Morgan Chase, Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns, which don't exist anymore, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, and so forth, were Citigroup, were creating toxic assets or manufacturing new securities out of subprime loans. That's a kind of old story at this point. But I just want to explain a little bit of it because it relates to where we are today and how the same stuff is going on just on a broader scale and just kind of in more secret at the same time. Toxic assets or securitized stuff, whether it is securitized subprime mortgages or corporate loans or debt or toll road payments or wine receipts. Doesn't matter. But the idea is that you are sticking a bunch of stuff into a larger security and it's supposed to pay interest. And based on how much interest it pays into that security, the security is then cut up into other pieces and it itself pays interest to the investors or the buyers of those pieces. And there is something called a waterfall or hierarchy about those pieces called tranches. And the idea is that you have kind of an order. And if you buy what's considered to be the most purest piece, the piece that's going to get its interest payments first and therefore pay the investors their interest payments first for buying it, that's a higher rated piece. That's a AAA piece. You start to go down the slices or the tranches of that security, you get to the bottom at something called an equity tranche. And the reason it's called an equity tranche or an equity piece is because it will not pay out anything until all of the other payments have gone out to all the other different investors that have bought all of the different slices of this larger security. The problem is if no interest payments are going into the security, or if there is fraud about the amount of interest payments going into the security, nothing comes out. So nobody gets paid. And ultimately, 60 to 70% of the worst assets that were created during the financial crisis by the major banks, who then sold them on to different countries and different municipalities and pension funds and so forth, weren't paying anything. That's why the financial crisis happened, because what happens when banks aren't able to receive from each other the payments that they bought and sold on some of these securities in the process of selling them elsewhere, they start to close their doors. They either close their doors sort of forever and companies go bankrupt, like Bear Stearns, which almost did, but instead got sold to J.P. Morgan Chase and Lehman Brothers, which just kind of dissipated. But otherwise, these institutions stopped trusting each other, and the system collapsed. And what happened in the wake of that collapse was both a political and a monetary solution to the collapse and to fix what was called the systemic or the emergency systemic problem of the financial system, which was to infuse these banks with money. So not only did we, as a government, bail them out, which was a small portion of the sort of subsidies they received, the largest banks, but also our main central bank, the Federal Reserve, got involved in manufacturing money in order to repay them. So rather than, say, fixing some of these assets, some of these actual mortgages that made up these securities, which would have been a far cheaper solution, and we wouldn't be anywhere near the situation of instability that we are actually in today, they decided to instead infuse these same banks with more money. Now, what happened in the wake of the financial crisis with respect to private banks from the central banks is nothing like that. What has happened in the last 10 years, and starting in 2008, is that the Federal Reserve led all the other major central banks to infuse their private banking system with a lot of money. How do they do this? By a strategy called quantitative easing. You're giving them money and you're buying stuff from them in return to make it look like you're having an equal exchange. You're basically buying either treasury bonds back from these private banks, who, as I mentioned to you, are basically in the center of the Treasury Department and where they sell those Treasury bonds to anyway. So you're creating a triangle where the Federal Reserve effectively buys Treasury bonds, starting, it's one of the elements of quantitative easing, the first round, QE1, bought Treasury bonds from the banks that got them from the Treasury Department and gave them back to the Fed, and the Fed gave them cash. The U.S. issues debt, and the banks get money. I mean, that's what it is. And the reason it's easing is because if you buy treasury bonds, the price of them goes up. If anyone buys them, right? If anybody buys anything and there's enough demand for it, you know, the price will go up. In bond math, if the price goes up, the rate goes down. And that was how the Fed not only kept rates down from engineering rates down, from saying the Fed funds rate, the rate that banks pay each other to borrow money, we are going to keep calibrating downward to zero, which they did. But in order to keep it there, we're also going to give them money, buy bonds, have the price of the bonds go up, have the rates go down, and that's going to just be an additional sort of downward pressure on rates. And then they didn't just buy treasury bonds from these banks, they also bought their crappy mortgage bonds. So the 35% of mortgage bonds that didn't sort of combust are hanging out at some of these banks, or they're hanging out as composites of other pieces of mortgage bonds at some of these banks, and nobody's buying them because they're crap. So the Fed decides to buy them. So what that does is it doesn't just give the banks who were holding them more cash in return for the Fed taking those bonds. It also means that because there was demand, even though it was the Fed who was demanding these bonds, they can reprice upward all the other crap they have on their books. It's true, right? I mean, if you have a garage sale and you put all your, like, crappy couches and, like, old TVs and chipped mugs and stuff in one place, and someone's like, oh, I got this really cool chip mug. It's awesome. I just paid $100 for it. Then you're going to mark up your next chip mug. You're not going to be like, well, it's only actually worth 50 cents. And that's exactly what banks did. They're like, okay, the Fed altogether collectively bought $4.5 trillion worth of bonds from the banks. Trillion. So the GDP of the United States now is just under $20 trillion. So that's like 25% of GDP equivalent. But it's also an even higher percentage of the assets that the big six banks are and were holding. It's about 60 to 65% equivalent to the assets that the top six banks are holding. So it's a lot of cash to be infused into banks in order to get crappy bonds or even treasury bonds. But that's the current status of the Fed's book. Now, there's different things they could have done instead with that money. They could have, for example, helped to fortify the mortgages of people who had been screwed by the banks. They could have decided to, you know, build better highways. They could have decided to, you know, have high-speed trains like they do in China and Japan that actually work and are awesome. I'm from California. I live partly in LA and in a town called Ojai, which was affected by the Thomas Fire in December. I evacuated the first night from the fire, you know, and it's not like the Fed's money could have kept the fire from occurring, but the Fed's money could have, or in general, conceptually, prevented the damage that the mudslides incurred upon surrounding towns after the fire, because there would have been actual funding to create sustainable methods of keeping slides down when the rains came, which was an inevitable sort of seasonal thing. It's something that's happened in New Mexico as well. I mean, there's things that money could have been used or set aside for rather than simply buying these crappy bonds or buying debt that otherwise would not have been needed from the Treasury Department. Other things could have been done with that money. They weren't. And it wasn't just the Fed that was doing this. What happened was the Fed decided to sustain our financial system in this manner. But it also was like, well, it's a global world. These financial markets are interlocked. These banks are interdependent. They trade with each other. Their investors borrow from them significantly to then go and buy other assets, stocks, bonds, and so forth. Like, we can't just have one country try to monitor its rates and buy bonds from its banks to keep rates down and money into these banks. We have to make this global. And so what the Fed did was it got the European Central Bank involved, and it got the Bank of Japan involved, and Switzerland, and it basically said, look, we need this to happen collectively. Now, these banks didn't necessarily face the same initial crises that the U.S. faced, because for the most part, it was our banks that screwed up the entire world. It really wasn't the other banks. The other banks were a part of it, but they didn't have the same impact because they hadn't been manufacturing the toxic assets in the amounts that our banks manufactured them and sold them on to the rest of the world. So collectively, the major central banks in the world didn't just manufacture the $4.5 trillion that the Fed manufactured to go into our banking system instead of going into anything real. They manufactured almost $22 trillion. And they are still holding the assets, the bonds that they bought with this money they manufactured on their books. And this is just the G7 central banks. So it's effectively taken a decade of this process to continue, and it's still continuing, to really manifest what's an artificial market. So we look at the stock market, which is, you know, roaring, you know, up at, you know, historic highs, going from 24, 25, 26,000 and so forth. And we have a president who's taking credit for that. And not that the last president didn't also take credit. I mean, this finance is completely bipartisan. It really doesn't matter what whoever's in power says. There are legislation issues that do matter, but from the standpoint of money in, money out, it really doesn't make a difference. The capital doesn't care. And so what's happened in the last year is what had been happening over the last 10 years, which is that markets have been bolstered by this central bank money that's gone into the private banks, that's gone into the major speculators, and that has lifted all these asset classes up to make up for the fact that rates are generally, on average, 0% for these banks. So in order to keep that entire global 0%, if the Fed starts to raise its rates, which it did for the first time by 25 basis points at the end of 2015, and then several times in 2016, three times last year. They've raised them a bit from zero. But other banks have lowered theirs or grown their quantitative easing measures. So the net result globally, collaboratively or collusively, is that we maintain this system where central banks are effectively lifting these markets. And then you add in things like the GOP tax plan. And what does that do? It enables companies who have been spending the last number of years buying their own stock with cheap money because they get to borrow at cheaper rates because, A, rates are down everywhere, and, B, their sort of bank mentors are working with them to create this debt because then they make money. They're effectively continuing now with an additional tax cut to buy more of their shares. So this isn't like they are actually paying people more or they are creating more jobs or creating more infrastructure or anything like that. And they've said this. They've admitted this. This is all sort of public knowledge. They are simply buying their own shares. And all of it has been connected to these policies of basically infusing the system with cheap money and allowing it to artificially stimulate the markets. That's not an inherently stable system. Any sort of alteration too quickly could unravel all of what's happened in the last 10 years. And when they unravel debt markets first. They unravel the companies that borrowed money and borrowed too much relative to what they were able to bring in, the countries that borrow too much money, the countries that borrow too much money in dollars, as the dollar has been declining in the wake of all of these sort of bizarre policies, and ultimately defaults or the inability to repay this debt starts to become the norm. It's not really there yet. Because they're sitting there trying to figure out how not to make that happen. So in terms of just ending on a sort of more positive note, there's a couple things that can be done. And again, both of them are things that I've been trying to talk to our congresspeople about, and you guys can help, just bother them. It's always good. Our banking system has not been reformed. It's not been restructured. We've not returned to a Glass-Steagall environment, which is something, if any of you have read any of the work I've done, I've been advocating since before I left Wall Street. What happens now is all of that artificial money, all of that extra subsidy that's going into the banking system is doing so, and it's collateralized by our deposits. So if a bank wants to buy its own stock, which Jamie Dimon announced J.P. Morgan would do to the tune of $19 billion last year, and that's just 1 year. They're doing it on the back of not giving it as services, let's say, or additional interest payments to its own depositors, but they're doing it because, like, they can, and no one's going to say anything about it. And that's because the depositors and the checking accounts are in the same institution as the other side of the institution, which gets to trade and gets to reformulate new toxic assets and structured products. But now they're not made out of mortgages. They're made out of all that corporate debt and all the corporate loans that have been given out cheaply over these 10 years because rates have been so low. And so the same thing will happen again when those combust. There has been no change in the way in which they operate or the securities that they create, except for, like, the stuffing. So instead of, like, a cherry pie, it's a blueberry pie, it's still a pie. So that needs to happen. Those things need to be separate because then you get to a situation where when you play blackjack as a bank, you're playing with your own money. Then you're playing with your shareholders' money and not the implicit guarantee that the government will be there to back you because you are holding insured depositors' money of millions of people in your country and millions of people in other countries to their private banks throughout the world. So that's something that needs to happen. And also infrastructure. Like things need to get built from this money. You could take $4.5 trillion of the debt that's sitting on the assets that are sitting on the Fed's book and just divert some of them into, for example, a public bank or an infrastructure bank where you can actually use that to fund real growth. And whether that is from an engineering perspective, whether that's from a research perspective, whether that is from, you know, rebuilding areas, you know, in terms of levees, in terms of, like, reducing, you know, mudslide danger, whatever it might be, having higher speed railways, competing with the rest of the world from that component, rather than having to quibble, which is what the current infrastructure conversation is in Washington, about whether or not $200 billion, Fed has $4.5 trillion, whether $200 billion of federal money can go in into an infrastructure bill and be matched by $800 billion from states to build infrastructure. So what is being discussed by both parties, but sort of debated, is whether this $1 trillion infrastructure bill, which is less than a quarter of the amount that the Fed manufactured to buy bonds, it can even be $1 trillion of federal money. It's not even being discussed at that level. It's $200 billion of federal money. That's what's being discussed. That does not grow a country. And that is something that's going on throughout the world. I mean, it's worse here because we were the country that sustained our banks with the most amount of liquidity from our central bank, and then we exported that type of a strategy. In China, for example, they also manufacture money, and they also create a lot of debt, and they also have a top-heavy system from that perspective. But they are using it to actually build infrastructure in China, but also to create trade alliances throughout Southeast Asia and even with respect to Latin America and Mexico and countries that are sort of being excluded now from trade policy talks with the United States or just having problems politically and are basically not just trying to impose politics on them. They're trying to give them funds with which to build infrastructure throughout the world. Are there problems with China and how they do things? Yes. Are there problems with how we do things? Yes. But there is funding going on for real real development. And real development creates actual jobs, and actual jobs create the manifestation of actual wages, and actual wages get used to buy things in the actual economy as opposed to being done on just sort of borrowed money, which is just then part of this whole pyramid of debt that's been created since the crisis. So those are things that can be done. So this arc that's gotten me in front of you today, and again, I'm very honored to be here. I'm really thrilled you all came out. Is part of really trying to dissect what's happened in the world even before I was involved in the financing of it, but also see where we can go from here. Money and economics is actually, it's a people's thing. It's not something that needs to just be dictated by the individuals that gather for champagne and skiing, whatever, at Davos. They're the things that like we need to do, and we can do. We can do it by every decision we make every day. So with that, I just want to, again, thank you for listening and for being here, and giving this evening to each other.
That was former Wall Street executive turned whistleblower Nomi Prinz. She spoke on January 24, 2018 at the Lannan Foundation in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Her recent book is Collusion: How Central Bankers Rigged the World. For the full audio or video, go to the website of the Lannan Foundation and search for Nomi Prinz, NOMIPRINS. The Lannan Foundation is a family foundation dedicated to cultural freedom, diversity, and creativity. They support exceptional contemporary artists and writers, as well as Native activists in rural indigenous communities. Come back when TUC Radio returns for an interview of Nomi Prinz by Juliet Shore that followed the talk. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.